Hi, everybody. This is Marlene with Miami Ghost Chronicles: Stories of the Supernatural, and today, the show is going to be about missing people in the Everglades National Park. But this really started with my interest in the work of a gentleman by the name of David Paulides, who's written several books about people that have gone missing in national parks. As a matter of fact, it's referred to as Missing 411. And before I get into the rest of it, let me tell you a little bit about what his premise is or what Missing 411 is all about. And basically, he's written a series of self-published books that document unsolved cases of people who have gone missing in national parks. Now, according to Mr. Paulides, his work on this subject began when he was doing research in a national park when an off-duty park ranger approached him and expressed concern about the questionable nature of some of the missing person cases which had occurred in the parks, in different parks. And the ranger knew about Paulides' background because prior to this, he's actually a cryptozoologist with a background in law enforcement, but he was involved in cryptozoology as far as the Bigfoot investigations. So the ranger knew about his background and asked him if he could research this issue, and he did so. And according to him, he uncovered multiple lines of evidence suggesting negligence on the part of the Park Service in failing to locate these missing people. And then he broadened the investigation to include missing people from across the world. And this led him to believe that he's uncovered a mysterious series of worldwide disappearances defying logical and conventional explanations. Now, I'm gonna go ahead and let you listen to a short clip of an interview that was done with David Paulides, and the most interesting or disturbing part of it is an excerpt that they're going to include in that interview of the disappearance in 2015 of a gentleman out of Minneapolis by the name of Henry McCabe. And it's not that he disappeared. That in and of itself is what was the recording that was left on his wife's voicemail. And you'll see what I mean when you listen to it. So go ahead and listen to this short excerpt. You're going to find it super interesting.
Now, in this last book of mine called A Sobering Coincidence, I talk about a number of these disappearances where the person that disappeared is on the phone with somebody as they vanish. And what they say is completely bizarre. Sometimes they'll say, "Where are you? I need you here now." Boom, phone goes dead. They're found in a river, 3 miles away, 30 days later. Now, here's probably one of the most bizarre cases you will ever hear. Henry McCabe, 32 years old, he's an auditor for the state of Minnesota, a revenue auditor, very smart man, did a lot of public speaking to businesses and things about revenue Minnesota. On the 7th of September, he went out with some friends. And at 2:30 approximately, he tells a buddy, "Hey, just drop me at the gas station. I'm going to get something to eat, and I'm just going to walk home." He gets dropped at the gas station, and at 2:28, the phone goes to his. He makes a call to his wife, Karen McCabe, and it goes to voicemail, and it's recorded. And the wife said, "It sounds like he was injured." There's a pause. Somebody says stop it, but intermixed with that for 2 minutes is a series of moans, growls, and groans that are out of this world strange. And anybody can go online, Google Henry McCabe growls and sounds on a voicemail, and it's out there right now.
And you'll hear the ground, the groans?
You will. It's very explicit. It's nasty. Now, he disappears on September 7th. His wife gets this voicemail and thinks, "What the heck is going on?" They search everywhere for him. On November 2nd, you know, almost 2 months later, his body is found in a place called Rush Lake. And a kayaker is going down the lake, finds the body in the water, calls the sheriff. Sheriff comes out, pulls the body out, and they say it's freshwater drowning. Now, in my last book, I talk about something called GHB. GHB is almost like a paralytic drug that makes you know what's happening to your body, but you can't move. And years ago, it used to be called a date rape drug. Now, in several of the cases I chronicled, the coroner went above and beyond their normal screening for drugs, and they screened for other things. And they found these super exorbitantly high levels of GHB in several of these people's bodies. Now, when you read things as though the parent says, yeah, he was a great swimmer, but if they had these super high levels of GHB in their system, they couldn't swim. So if a determination comes down that they drowned, well, they didn't drown because they didn't try. They drowned because they couldn't get out. They couldn't move. Now, and you start to think, well, you know, did somebody at a bar drug them? No. And the reason being is that the levels of the GHB that are found in their bodies, when it's tested for, are so far beyond the norms of what we see in people that have had date rape drugs. You have to think, how is it being administered and when is it being administered? And GHB is one of those things that's a naturally occurring agent in the human body. But one reason that it's a really good drug to use on somebody is that it comes out of your system really fast. And out of the, 20 drugs that a normal medical examiner screens for, GHB is not one.
These cases just get stranger and stranger and stranger, David. Politis. David, would you briefly set up again the Henry McCabe story? And we're going to play the clip from an old television station I worked at in 1978, KSTP in Minneapolis, St. Paul. We're going to play their little news clip of his disappearance. You'll hear some of that audio you were talking about. But briefly set up that situation again.
Okay, so Henry was a revenue person for the state of Minnesota, straight arrow kind of guy. Family man, never got in any trouble, was somebody that was always looked up to by people around him. He was out drinking with some friends on September 7, 2015, about 2:30 in the morning. He's dropped at a Holiday gas station by a friend at Central and Hackman. He's a resident of Mounds View, kind of a northern part of Minneapolis-St. Paul. His wife's name is Corrine. He calls his wife while he's out and he's not home. She is asleep. It goes to voicemail. His body's found November 2nd at a place called Rush Lake, supposedly died from freshwater drowning.
Okay, let's listen to this report from KSTP in Minneapolis, St. Paul.
It's a voicemail unlike anything you've ever heard before. There are 2 minutes worth of noises, bizarre ones, with very little actual talking. Authorities confirmed the disturbing middle-of-the-night call came from Henry McCabe's cell phone. It was Labor Day, September 7th at 2:28 in the morning. McCabe's worried wife heard the message.
His and my cell phone connected.
Minnesota Community Policing Services is a nonprofit agency and acts as a go-between with police and the Liberian community. The leader is trying to help the family make some sense of this recording.
The growls turned to high-pitched moans.
Like he's moaning in pain.
Like moaning in pain.
The tortured grunts suddenly stop. There is silence. Then someone, either Henry or another person, says, "Stop it."
I try to picture where he was, what it might have been like, what circumstances would have made him sound like that.
The voicemail is in stark contrast to other articulate recordings of McCabe speaking at an event. He's a state auditor.
What is the justification? What is the right thing to do?
The message is one piece of evidence Moundsview police are reviewing. The police chief tells me even the FBI is analyzing the recording and voices for clues. The chief says the investigation took deputies here on Tuesday. To Rice Creek Park, which borders New Brighton, Moundsview, and Fridley, all areas where McCabe was reported seen or a cell phone ping placed him. Ramsey County Water Patrol searched but came up empty.
Arms and spine listening to that. Those sounds, the moans and the growls, they're horrible.
It's definitely something that's unbelievably odd, because when his body was found, they said that there was no sign of injury, no torture. He just drowned, George.
Jeez. I'm wondering if in his course of being a state auditor, if he was stumbling across something or a company that they were auditing, and somebody got upset with him? I don't know.
Yeah, apparently the feeling of law enforcement is that it's just, quote-unquote, a standard freshwater drowning, nothing unusual, other than the tape.
And the tape is not just a drowning. There's something weird going on there.
Exactly.
Wow. Wow. I would put that way up on your charts, my friend. That's a strange one.
It's odd. And can you imagine being the wife and hearing that?
Oh, my God. On your answering machine, and you know it came from his phone?
Yeah.
The question, too, is, I mean,
where he is, what happened to him for weeks?
I mean, did he initiate the call? Did somebody else do it? Were they playing a game, a sick game? Who knows?
Well, I, again, if you go back to what I've chronicled in the past, that there have been several times where people have disappeared being on the phone, and it's as though they're seeing something that scares them to death, or something else is happening, but there are these conversations that end suddenly, and the person's gone.
And I would assume police have no idea, no idea what that voice was.
Well, what is interesting, and I didn't bring it up, but I should have, is the FBI involvement. In my books, I explain that the FBI, in a strange way, shows up at these cases where they shouldn't even be involved.
Yes, you're right.
This isn't a case for the FBI. This is a local case of a missing guy, case that they don't normally investigate, but they're there to look into it. Now, they have a profiling team that looks at cases like this. When an agent goes out and monitors a case, looks into it, he writes a report. That report goes to the profiling team, and they look for other cases that have the similar elements, and they combine them. And that's how they gather and they get to know if something is matching in another part of the country.
It's almost like they have their own X-Files when it has to do with this case, these cases.
For sure.
All right, now that you heard that clip about David Politi's explaining what his work is about, and specifically about that case and about Henry McCabe, which has so many loose ends, I said, okay, you know, I live basically, I've got the Everglades as my backyard. So I said, that's one of the largest national parks that we have in the United States. So I said, let me see what I can find out. And, you know, obviously I can't do the type of research that he's done. But right off the bat, I found two of them. And let me let you go ahead and listen to the story about the first one. And this is something that, like I said, I just found right off the top. Now, this is about somebody, a jockey, who basically rode into oblivion. Okay. Now, his name was Al Snyder. Okay. Now, back in early March of 1948, okay, he was a very successful jockey. At that time, as a matter of fact, he had just finished winning a race here in Miami-Dade County in the Hialeah racetrack. Hialeah back then was a sleepy little town, and about the most exciting thing that happened there was the horse racetrack, which would, of course, because of the great weather we have down here, they would host all the wintertime horse races. And he had just, besides that one, he had won a lot of races, but this jockey was doing fantastic. So that's the reason why he was down here in South Florida. He had been participating in some horse races. And normally he was the regular rider of Calumet Farms' magnificent colt named Citation. And he, along with two friends, a trainer, C.H. Toby Trotter, and businessman Donald Frazier, they set sail from Miami for a week-long fishing trip in the Florida Keys. On the afternoon of March 5th, the trio left their yacht, which was anchored in Sandy Key, to go fishing in a 15-foot skiff. They planned to return within an hour. They carried with them reserve fuel, a jug of water, life jackets, 75 inches of rope, extra spark plugs. I take that back. I believe that's 75 feet of rope. Extra spark plugs, a bailing pail, oars, and an anchor. Friends left behind on the yacht could see the skiff about a mile away. Darkness falls, and the men were lost to view. Now, not long after that, the captain of a passing boat saw the three men. And there was no sign of any trouble, and the sea was calm. The skiff was a half mile from land and in shallow water, no deeper than 4 feet. If the boat ran into trouble, they could easily swim or even wade ashore. I myself have been in this area, and I can vouch that in those areas right off the Keys, it is very shallow water there. As a matter of fact, if you're in a motorboat, you have to be real careful not to get stuck in the sand. So I can attest myself personally that that's pretty accurate. But anyway, like they said, you know, if that boat would have run into trouble, they could have swam or just walked to shore. Now, what happens is Snyder and his companions were never seen again. A week later, a search party found the skiff or this little dinghy, but not the slightest trace of the three men was ever found. Another oddity was that the boat was completely empty. Oars, seat cushions, everything was gone. Now, although their disappearance was officially ruled as an ordinary accident at sea, no one really knows what happened to the trio. If they were swept overboard by the sudden storm that blew in over 2 hours after they were last seen, they were close enough to land to make it odd that their bodies or even life jackets or clothing never turned up. And why would they still have been out fishing in the darkness hours after their planned return to the yacht? Lawrence Boydo, one of the friends who remained on the yacht, later commented, "I just can't figure what they were doing for the 2 hours or more before the storm hit." There was some been some darker rumors about the tragedy, something about that maybe, you know, he wasn't, you know, letting himself get bribed for fixing a race, but that really has been dismissed totally. And 4 months after the men disappeared, a barnacle encrusted bottle washed ashore in the Keys, and it had a message inside which read, "Help, one dead. No joke. AL as in Al. S period." Whether it was a sick hoax or a baffling clue, no one ever really knew. Now that horse that he was riding, Citation, it went on with a new jockey by the name of Eddie Acaro to win the Kentucky Derby, and that jockey was nice enough to give Snyder's wife half of the winnings from that race, because if Snyder wouldn't have disappeared, he was the jockey that was supposed to have ridden in the Kentucky Derby. And as a matter of fact, that horse went on to win the Preakness and the Belmont and a lot of other major races, which is the Triple Crown in Kentucky. And I read into it, the boat was found, that dinghy was found in Rabbit Key in the Everglades. Stripped down, like they described, totally stripped down, in an area off the west coast of the Everglades, you know, where the Everglades ends on the west side, which is called 10,000 Islands. And they had literally hundreds of people looking for this man, for all of them, for all those days. They had planes, they had everything that was at their disposal in that year of 1948. They couldn't find anything. And as a matter of fact, one of the locals said, even if they would have washed offshore, some of these islands, they could have stayed alive because there's shellfish. If they had any of their fishing equipment, you know, they could have, in other words, fed themselves. So again, this is a very unusual disappearance. Again, besides Snyder, which he had two other people with him, these were all people who were successful, basically almost at the peak of, as far as Snyder was concerned, of his career. And he's out on vacation and he ends up disappearing. And the only clue found was found in the Everglades, which is that boat stripped of everything, which if you know, I'm going to go ahead and later on, I'm going to let you hear a little bit more about David Paulides' theories. And one of them is that he's found in all these cases from all these different parks is that inclement weather happens very, very close to the time of the disappearance of these people. Okay. Many times it does happen in or near a body of water. In some cases, you know, some people have been found alive with no memory whatsoever of where they were. Others are found dead in very unusual places where search parties have gone back and forth a million times and they've never been found. Sometimes they've been gone for days and days, but when they're found, their bodies they don't look like someone that's been out in the wilderness. It's very strange, very perplexing theories. And let me go ahead and let me get going on to the second case here. In this one, I know that you're going to find, and this one, as a matter of fact, just happened like about 6 years ago. Same thing, disappearance in the Everglades. Okay, now the second case involves a gentleman. This happened in March of 2011. It's a little bit over 6 years ago. And it involves a man by the name of Roger Sawyer, 67 years old. He disappeared while he and his family were camping in the Everglades National Park campground in Flamingo. And this was at the end of a cross-country trip that they were doing in their motorhome. Now, Mr. Sawyer was a retired Oregon butcher. He was said by his family to be an experienced outdoorsman. And he disappeared virtually without a trace. And as of today, still remains missing. And initially, they searched for him for almost like about a month. And his family stayed here about 30 days before they returned to Oregon. During that first month, they were a little bit reticent to speak to the media. And there was a little bit of confusion about that. But one of the, finally, when they did start talking about what had happened, what they described was that he had his family, and one of the family members was saying how Roger, his wife, and one of the family members, they were all in the motorhome together. They took the motorhome through the Florida Keys, and then, as a matter of fact, this was his daughter-in-law who was making this comment. He would often say, like, I know yesterday I said I was the best day of my life, but today is the best day of my life. In other words, this gentleman sounds like he was an optimist. He doesn't sound like he was depressed or suicidal or anything, because I know that's what a lot of people think when somebody disappears like this. Now, after the Keys, they brought the motorhome to Everglades National Park. And when they get there, some of the family members, they go over to the visitor center while Sawyer and his wife Paula remain behind. Now, The daughter-in-law says how Sawyer and his wife, they were in different areas of the campground, but as darkness falls, all right, and people are starting to return to the motorhome, they realize that Roger Sawyer is not among them. So they call the park officials, and of course they contact Miami-Dade Fire Rescue, and they start searching for him. They didn't find a shoe, a hat. They looked in the water, along the beach. In other words, they looked just about every place that they could think of that he could possibly be at. Now, the park services, along with the fire rescue, they coordinated the search, and they gave a little bit of information to the media. But, and this was something really unusual, and it's unusual in the sense of that little information was given to the media, and also because Paulides does describe similar circumstances in other cases of missing people where somehow or other, even though the person is searched for, at the same time, they kind of hold back on giving out information even after the fact, even years after the fact, about the disappearance of the circumstances. But anyway, supposedly what was said that the spokesperson for the national park, the Everglades National Park, said that the family said that they didn't want to speak to any reporters and that they were not even willing to provide a photo of this man. And about a month after, when the media finally got in touch with these family members, they were saying that this was not true. Okay. As a matter of fact, that claim was confirmed by a park spokesperson. Now, they kept on searching for Roger, and the one that was handling that was the U.S. Park Service, and something called an incident team. And they were saying that it was that team's decision to separate the media and the family. Okay. And this was according to the Everglades National Park Public Information Officer. Bottom line, those first 30 days, which you would think would be one of the most important, this information was not disseminated to the public via the media to raise awareness about what had happened to him, what he looked like. But anyway, finally, that incident team made the decision to provide a photo of Roger to the media, which by this time had made multiple requests asking, hey, give us a photo of this guy. But at the same time, they were making it seem like the family didn't want to make the photo available. So they were out there 30 days. Finally, when the media actually spoke to the family, they were saying they were thrilled when they first saw the first stories air about Roger missing, because they understood how important it would be to get exposure about what had happened. At the end of the day, despite all the, you know, confusion there was as to why the media didn't get the information right away and who really, you know, made that decisions, like I said, even though the family was out there for 30 days after he disappeared, they did search for him actually 10 days. They just don't know what happened to him. First of all, he was in good health. His mind was unclouded. He didn't have dementia. He was a woodsman. In other words, his background was a woodsman. And bottom line, he disappeared in a national park without a trace. And if you go by the timeline of what they describe, they were looking for him pretty much maybe within a few hours, give or take, to try to find him. This wasn't somebody that was disappeared for several days before somebody realized he was missing. Without knowing the exact moment that he disappeared, at the most it was just several hours. And at some point, they thought, well, if they couldn't find any trace of him, was it because he was taken out of the park? Again, that would be, it makes you wonder, why would anybody take a man of that age? How could they have taken him without any noise, a scuffle? You see his picture there. I could see where he would fight back if anybody was trying to abduct him or hit him or anything like that. So, like I said, this was back in March of 2011. And as of today's date, this remains an unsolved disappearance that occurred in Everglades National Park. And this is in a visitor's campground area. The family was there. This was March. Around that time, we have all these campgrounds are pretty full because there's a lot of visitors from up north who come into all these parks. So without having been there, I'm pretty positive that that place was full of tourists and people walking around. So again, this falls into, I don't know about the weather, but definitely this did occur inside a national park. It occurred close to a body of water. You check off some of the different common denominators that Paulides has found, not in all, but in a good portion of the different disappearances that he's had all over the country. And again, these weren't even, you can't say, well, these were women or children, even though there have been disappearances where you could say, well, are we talking a predator, serial killer, somebody, a pedophile, somebody that abducts a child, or, I mean, no, these were two cases of two men, again, with no reason to either commit suicide or to decide that they wanted to just disappear and become somebody else. And so we come right back to the beginning is, what happened to them? Where did they go? And or who or what took them? Hi, everybody. This is Marlene with Stories of the Supernatural. And this is an update to this story that I did a few years ago as far as these two cases. Of course, one is set many years ago, and obviously the disappearance of that jockey was never resolved. Nothing was ever found. As far as the other story, dating to 2011, for Roger Sawyer, where I'm talking here, we're 2023, he disappeared 2011, fast forward 12 years, he's still missing. As a matter of fact, you can find him on the Charlie Project, which lists all the unsolved cases of people that have gone missing. As of this year, he's still a missing person, which means nothing has been found to indicate either him or something maybe that would even lead to think that he might be dead. So I want to bring you up to speed on that. And, I was born and raised in Miami. I moved to North Florida in the last couple of years, but basically I'm very familiar with the Everglades. I grew up in the area where the Everglades was always back there. And just so anybody knows, this is the Florida Everglades has about 1.5 million acres. All right. And of course it's a subtropical climate. And this is why I'm sure you've heard that there's a lot of invasive species that have basically blossomed and taken over, almost threatening the ecosystem that's there. Point being that people can get lost in there, and God knows, growing up there, you knew that every once in a while they would find human remains, if they were found, and between the predators and the hot climate and the insects, it could do away with any type of evidence, especially tissue. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful place. But, you know, you've got a bunch of animals there that will eat what's left of a human body.
And of course, places like this always have some folklore of a sinister type. Let's put it this way. Since 1965, all right, we're talking almost like over 50 years, there have been about 175 unsolved cases that are involving death and murder. And again, let me stress, these are the bodies that were found. All right. Now, again, some of them, maybe just nobody stumbled over them, what's left of them. Others, of course, could have been eaten by any of the predators that are out there. And of course, let's face it, even I remember back in the 1980s when the cocaine wars were raging in Miami, out there, what was called Alligator Alley was infamous for being a dumping ground for sometimes people that they even never got to identify. Sometimes these people had come from out of the country, they had no identification, and of course, away they go. These are people that were freshly found. And of course, besides this, there's urban legends, the true crime stories, but I want to give you an example of three of the most famous ones. The first one, it's very well known of, it's called the Lost Patrol, and this started back in December of 1945. By then, World War II has ended, and Flight 19, all right, they left Naval Air Station to Fort Lauderdale, right, in what was considered good weather. There was no storms, no thunder, no approaching hurricane, none of the above. Matter of fact, at this point in December, we're outside of the hurricane season down in South Florida. Now, this squadron, if you want to call them that, the flight, it included five TBM Avengers and 14 crew members. And all they were going to do was to go out for a two-hour patrol and come back to base. Now, as a matter of fact, I even have a separate video that they, besides they went out to like by the Bimini, they took pot shots at this wreck that was there from Prohibition days called the USS Sampona. And they were supposed to come right back. And the pilot, towards the end of the 2 hours, contacts the Fort Lauderdale Tower. And instead of saying, hey, we're returning to base, tells them we're lost. They're asked what their position is, but he couldn't tell them. Now, next 30 minutes, this tower is listening to all these voices from the crew members of Flight 19. And they're noticing that these men are all going through some type of panic. It's escalating before everything went silent. In other words, this was not one plane that had a malfunctioning radio or instruments. We're talking here various planes, all that seem to be experiencing this same type of malfunction. And afterwards, there was complete silence. The Fort Lauderdale base, they sent out a search team because they're thinking for some reason these planes went down. They sent out what's called a PBM Mariner, or a flying boat, to go with rescue equipment and 13 crew members. But guess what? They disappeared as well. Again, here we come back. Clear skies, calm sea, no war is ongoing. World War II is over. And what it boils down to is that there was no explanation for not one, but two of those flights to completely disappear without a trace. Again, what this means is not only were there no crew members found, there was no wreckage found. Of course, immediately they send out more personnel to scour hundreds of miles of ocean. They even went to the Everglades searching. Now, almost over 77 years later, again, no trace has ever been found of the men, the wreckage, floating debris, nothing. There's different theories. Of course, one of the most famous that you hear out there is that because they were flying inside the Bermuda Triangle, they got lost in some vortex electromagnetic storm, who knows, which is what threw their instruments into disarray, and basically went into a wormhole. As a matter of fact, I want to say it's one of the most well-known urban legends, having to do with the Bermuda Triangle and the Atlantic, where there's a history, supposedly, of planes and ships that disappear. And again, it's you could say, was it? It's the how can I say this? The circumstances. Even if you're not a person that believes in things like the paranormal or much less like the Bermuda Triangle, the circumstances under which both of these groups of planes and men disappeared does beg a good question, as in, obviously something happened to them out of the norm when nothing has ever been found. Now, because, again, one of the reasons why the Everglades was searched was that they thought that they somehow or other had lost their way, and when they thought maybe they were heading north, they in actuality were heading west. Hard to say, considering, I don't know, where maybe they couldn't even track with the sun. Now, let's go back to another earlier time period. This is another urban, well, that's not a urban myth. This actually happened out in the Everglades, turn of the century, as a matter of fact. I have another video on that, and I'll put a link to all these videos on the credits of this show. What happens is that area of the Everglades, turn of the century, this was basically was no man's land. It was, besides, again, the heat, subtropical climate, mosquitoes, it got so bad that people that were fleeing from the law, et cetera, would usually go down there because, first of all, the law was few and far between, and the few that were there didn't want to go out to search in the swamps for anybody. So it ended up with a lot of people with, not the best reputations, especially ones that maybe had committed some really bad crimes, heading out to that area of the Everglades. One of them is a gentleman by the name of Edgar Watson. And as you know, back in those times, of course, there was Jesse James, you know, from the 1800s, and there was another lady named Belle Starr. And she was very notorious around that time period because they were all robbing and pulling stunts. And in Belle Starr's case, this was in Oklahoma, all right? And one of the people that was in the gang that she was involved in was a guy named Edgar Watson. He was born in 1855, and, long before he met an untimely end, I will tell you about, he already was demonstrating that he had some violent tendencies. He was always getting into fights, and that temper of his was what first got him involved in two murders, all right, which, of course, made him think, I need to get the heck out of Dodge, and heck out of Dodge pointed him out into Florida and then Oklahoma. And when he goes to Oklahoma, he rents land from Belle Starr. Now, according to the stories, it was Edgar who killed Belle Starr by shooting her in the back when she's on a horse. Now, he went to trial, but he was not convicted. He did have an outstanding warrant for an arrest in Florida, but he returned and then murdered another man. And of course, in this case, he claimed self-defense. Now, of course, these are the ones that he's being found out about and being tried, all right? He, of course, realizes, you know, I got to stay out of Oklahoma and I got to keep a low profile. And he basically, as a fugitive, he goes out to the Florida Everglades. And out there, he buys 40 acres and he builds a farm. This is, remember, the subtropical climate is great for raising sugarcane. And he starts a sugarcane plantation for syrup. And of course, who does he bring to work for him is out of town people, you know, down under luck, or even fugitives themselves. Now, at that time period, if you were a worker, of course, he's housing you on this plantation, but you would get paid at the end of the season, in other words. So what was he doing? He would not pay them. Come the end of the season, he would murder them, dump their bodies in the rivers, and that's it. And of course, word gets out, even in that small town, it was Chokoloskee, because they're finding these corpses washing up. And of course, they're thinking, okay, one person, two person, I guess it was a few. And at some point, somebody realized, hey, all these guys, they all work for Edgar Watson. And of course, he's denying everything. And back then, again, this is turn of the century, out in the Everglades. And of course, like even now, the authorities, police departments, they're pointing the finger at each other like, whose jurisdiction is it? In other words, nobody wanted to go out there. It's like, no, it's your jurisdiction. No, it's your jurisdiction. Guess what happens? The townspeople, like all things, decide to take justice into their hand, because at this point, believe it or not, they're worried about this guy because he's violent, and they're thinking he's getting rid of these workers, but pretty soon any of us could fall victim to him. And in 1910, he comes into this small trading post called the Smallwood Store. And the Smallwood Store, you know, besides selling goods, it was like the unofficial meeting place for the people that lived in that area. And guess who's there? A bunch of the townspeople, and they're armed, and they're asking him. They basically do the what the law enforcement should have done, which is they're asking him about the murders, and that he better fess up and say the truth. And of course, he doesn't confess. He tries to pull out his gun, and supposedly they say that his gun misfired. And from what I understand, he had a shotgun, but there had been a recent storm that had gone through, and they say that on purpose. He was sold some damp bullets or gunpowder from the Smallwood Store, and that's why his gun misfired. And in return, the townspeople killed him, shot him a lot of times. Smallwood Store, by the way, is still there. And there's always that ghost story that says that Edgar Watson still is around there or around the plantation. I think that, as a matter of fact, you can find it's a little island plantation. You can still find those sugar bowls where they would cook the sugar and to make the syrup. Now, the last story has to do, let's face it, out there, if you want to hide what you're doing, like as a moonshine still, that's the place to do it. And of course, let's fast forward a couple of years from when Edgar Watson is running around, and let's go to Prohibition times. And there's a place called out there, it's called Ghost Village, Lost City. And right now, there's no roads out there, and you can't find it on any map. It's hard to find. And as a matter of fact, I'd say that even sometimes when people do stumble on it, it's really hard to find it again. And it's only about 3 acres of land, and it's south of Alligator Alley. All right. Now, Alligator Alley is like divvies between Miami-Dade County and Broward County, and it runs east to west, like from the east coast or to west coast of Florida. And out there, you could go out there and especially remember, these are airboats. This is how people travel around in a lot of these areas, in the airboats. You know, you come to these hammocks and, you know, you'll find sometimes these rotting shacks. You know, a lot of the times hunters, they go out there and then they fall apart. One story is that they believe that some Confederate soldiers had taken some gold, they hid in the area, and then they were murdered by the Seminoles, who regarded the area sacred ground. I'm not sure. Seminoles and the Miccosukees, who are a little bit further south in Miami-Dade County, those were the tribes that were out there. Now, another story is that Al Capone, when moonshine is ripping and roaring, remember, he had a house over in Miami-Dade County. He sets up a moonshine distillery, and he even owned a bar off Miami Trail. So he's bootlegging. He's bringing in, you know, illegal hooch from off the coast, the rum runners, you know, off Bimini. You also got moonshine distilleries out in these hammocks and these you had to know where you were going or forget it. And so for him, this is a perfect place to distill moonshine. Because remember, this is different from, let's say, the rum and stuff that they would get out of the islands. Because Prohibition was here in the United States, but it wasn't illegal, let's say, like in the islands or Bimini, which was only like 60 miles off the coast. So sometimes what they would do is they would warehouse the liquor over there, and then just rum runners, they run it into the coast and drop it and bring it in. Now, once they get into the country, then of course it's legal. Now, and let's throw Skunk Ape into the mix, shall we? Supposedly this Lost City is where the Skunk Ape hangs out, you know, our version, the Florida version of the Bigfoot. And he's, of course, like other ones, he's been spotted, photographed. Some people have described encounters with him, but of course, no solid proof. And, but if anybody has been out there, or driven through Alligator Alley or US 41, which is runs parallel a little bit further south from Alligator Alley, you can see where anything is possible out there. All right, anybody could disappear willingly or unwillingly. Things can disappear willingly and unwillingly, and when you least expect it, you find it. And it's not surprising that some things never ever come to light. And again, this is just another taste of what it's like to live in South Florida. Thank you so much, and you are all wonderful. Come back for all my shows. Take care.